Hi, everybody. My name is Larcine. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I want to thank you for having me and my husband. We've been having an absolutely wonderful time. I want to thank Carol for inviting us to come out, and I want to thank with all my heart Bob and Robin who have been hosting us and just knocking themselves out, showing us a good time, and we've really enjoyed ourselves very much, and they've made us feel very welcome and a part of from the very beginning. And as my husband said, Dan took us on a battle, you know, wherever they did the fighting over there, and I love, see, this is the alcoholic version. If you heard my husband talk, he says, oh, yes, the 3A guys are in the front, and they're reading the map, working together as a team. We were lost. We were lost. The Al-Anons in the back got the map, showed the alcoholics where we were. If we'd have been with General Lee, he might have won. But anyway, we're having a great time, and it's real fun to be here, and I've enjoyed the workshops I've gotten to go to, and Beverly's talk last night was absolutely fabulous. She's a very dear friend, and I always get so much out of her sharing all the time. I'm not going to say much about my husband's talk because, you know, I have to go home with that alcoholic ego, so I'm just going to... But... you know, to tell you the honor and the privilege that it is to get to come and do this, you know, speaks for itself. But the honor and the privilege to get to come to, with my husband is absolutely, you know, talk about beyond your wildest dreams. If you heard my husband this afternoon, it's a miracle. I mean, it's just that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous and miracles are pretty much synonymous as far as I'm concerned. Because my husband was almost dead, and if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, you would have had a different speaker tonight. And my gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous knows absolutely no bounds. But anyway, I'm just going to kind of leap into this and tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm the oldest of four kids. My dad was a master sergeant in the Army. That made me the automatic corporal of my family. I have had rank since the day I was born, and... my husband jokes that I came out of the clipboard, you know, came out of the womb with a clipboard and an armband on, and he's not too far off the mark. My earliest recollections of going to school, I was always playground monitor, cafeteria monitor, classroom monitor, and that's because I've got no problems. If I see somebody doing something wrong, I will write your name down, and you will be reported, you know, I mean... I don't care if you're in the sixth grade. I don't care if you tell me you're going to hit me or beat me up after school. You know, by God, your name's going down. And what can I say? It's a gift. And it certainly was for me. And it's just the way that I was. And like I say, my dad was a master sergeant in the Army. When I was raised, it was with discipline. I mean, we were raised. He took our family like it was just another outfit in the Army. We had little army blankets on our bed. We had foot lockers at the end of our bed. And I loved it. I just liked knowing. Show me the rules and regulations, the table of operations, and then I'm off and I'm running. And I like that. And it worked for me. Didn't work for my sisters and it didn't work for my brother, but it definitely worked for me. And that's just what I learned pretty much early on. I also grew up in alcoholism, but I had absolutely no idea that I did as a kid growing up. How are you supposed to know? How are you supposed to have any kind of an inkling when that's your life from the very, very beginning? And that was definitely mine from the beginning. My dad was drunk every day. And to me, that was normal. That's just what dads did. They got drunk every day. And I grew up, we always lived in military housing with other military families. And a lot of dads were drunk every day. Hello. I know Dan did that. But anyway, and again, like I say, it was normal for me. That's just what I grew up in, and that's just how it was. And again, I had no idea that the drinking had any part about what went on in our life. For a very long time, I thought my dad was just a really mean man and a really angry man, and I couldn't understand why someone who was so angry and so hateful would bother to marry somebody and have children, you know, when he obviously didn't want anything to do with any of us. And again, I had absolutely no idea that it was the drinking, you know, that fed that behavior and caused him to act that way. And I had a lot of difficulties with my dad after I got into Al-Anon. When I got into Al-Anon, I was in Al-Anon 6 months when my dad died of alcoholism at the ripe old age of 55 years old. And my dad died the death that they talk about in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, total insanity and death. My dad never did much more than, drink beer. That was his alcohol of choice, and my dad died a beer drinker. But when my dad died, I was only in Al-Anon, like I say, 5 or 6 months. So I wasn't to the loving, forgiving portion of the program yet. You know, that didn't even come into the picture. And when my dad died, my attitude was, you know, ding dong, the witch is dead. You know, again, it's not anything, you know, it's the family disease of alcoholism. I was glad he was dead. My sisters were glad he was dead. It was like the reign of terror is over and he can't hurt us anymore. And I had to be in Al-Anon a while, and I had to do a lot of writing about that and a lot of step work on that. And I had, like I say, a lot of anger and a lot of resentment about it. And in working with my sponsor, these issues would still come up with me no matter all the writing and all the stuff. I did the footwork. I did the stuff I was instructed to do and still had a lot of problems with that. You know, and then my sponsor explained to me how, you know, alcoholism is such a negative disease. Just this big, giant negative is the family disease of alcoholism. And so she told me, you know, you've done all the writing, you've done the footwork, you've worked the steps, you've done what you're supposed to do about this. She goes, now, you know, what we need to do is take that negative and replace it with a positive. You have to step away from that if you want to get away from, you know, the negative effect of it affecting you for the rest of your life. And so what she gave me an assignment. She told me I was to think up something good my dad did. And I told her I didn't know that I could ever think of anything good my dad did. I just had so much negative feeling about the whole thing and a lot of resentment. But she gave me the assignment. I said I would try, and I did. And I went home and I thought for a couple of weeks, and then I remembered that my dad taught me how to drive. Now, if you're going to marry an alcoholic of your very own, especially in California, driving's like an essential tool if you're going to track them in any way, shape, or form. So I came up with, you know, my dad taught me how to drive. That's all I had. And so I went to her with that, and she says, that's good enough. That's all you need. She goes, now from now on, whenever those negative emotions about your father come into your head, I want you to remember that. I want you to replace that negative with a positive thought. You know, so I was able to do that. And then a couple of weeks later, I thought of a second good thing my dad had done. And I thought of a third good thing my dad had done. And a fourth good thing my dad had done. You know, and going to open Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, you know, I learned that my father had a disease. I also know, you know, that in going to meetings, you know, that my dad loved me to the best of his ability. He was a practicing alcoholic. He was a mean and violent alcoholic, no doubt about it, you know, but again, how it affected him and how that affected us as a family. And I don't mean to trivialize, you know, growing up in an alcoholic home and the trauma that, you know, you can have as a result of that. If I just trivializing it away to, oh, and then he taught me how to drive and I was all better about it. But the bottom line is that, you know, it had to be over. It just had to be over. When are you going to let it go? That's what my sponsor was just really trying to teach me. Yes, you grew up in this home, and Al-Anon has never told me that that was all okay. What Al-Anon has taught me is that's just the way that it was. That's just the way that it was. Now you're an adult woman. Are you going to keep living in that negative, you know, behavior? Are you going to keep letting that negative behavior affect you in a negative way? And when it affects me in a negative way, I don't know how you are, but garbage in, garbage out for me. You know, so what Al-Anon did was one more time, just give me tools to take that negative behavior and turn it into a positive one. You know, and now when I think about my dad, I think about a man who suffered from the disease of alcoholism, who died having his children glad that he was dead. You know, and I don't know that you can pay any bigger price than that. You know, it's not necessary for me to have to punish him anymore. And so I'm able to let that hate and that negativity go and replace it with a positive, you know, that accepting that my dad did the very best that he could. And I know today that he loved me as well as he was able to. But unfortunately, you know, how what happens for me is I've got this package about what I think it's supposed to look like, what I think your love is supposed to look like for me. You know, and my dad packaged up his love in the best way that he possibly could. And because I didn't recognize it the way I thought it was supposed to be, I missed the gift. And I know that the gift was there. But because of you, you know, I've got a partial, ability to have that now today. And I think that my dad would be very proud of me. And I think that I know he always loved me and he always cared about me. In the beginning, when I started coming to Al-Anon, I went to lots of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I can't really recommend enough, if you're new in Al-Anon, to go to open AA meetings. It says in our literature that we should learn all we can about the disease of alcoholism. You know, and to me, there's not a better place to learn that than in open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And kind of to describe like how I grew up in my home, it was, I was going to this open AA meeting one night, and there was a speaker, and I heard the speaker, and I don't know that this is really what he said, but what I heard him share about that night was alcoholism, the family disease. And he talked about alcoholism in the home like having a rhinoceros in your living room, but everybody pretends it's a coffee table. And that was just like the perfect description of the house that I grew up in, because we'd be all sitting around the dinner table and my mom would get to the part where she could tell when my dad was ready to have one of his alcoholic explosions. And she could never say to us kids, okay, your dad's going to blow up. Nobody say anything, nobody talk, because of course that would cause him to blow up. So what my mom would do, you know, and I've learned in Al-Anon, you know, the first thing that really goes out the window in any alcoholic home is any kind of verbal communication. And so my mom communicated to us facially. You know, and if you grow up in an alcoholic home, you know, this all means stuff, you know. I mean, there's significant meaning in those, you know, this is red alert, you know. And so my mom would do this, and we would all know that, you know, something terrible was going to happen imminently. But we would all try and be quiet. We would all try and do nothing. But someone would scrape a knife on a plate or spill some milk or some minor infraction, and boom, you know, everything would explode. Dinner would go flying across the room. Everybody would get a spanking, sent to their room crying. And this could be 5:30 in the afternoon. Everybody's in bed, including my mom, the dog. Everybody's got to go. And then the next morning, you'd get up and you'd get that courage to kind of creep down the hallway into the kitchen, and there'd my dad be sitting with his morning glass of beer, and it would be, you know, and you'd want, you know, good morning, what do you want for breakfast? You know, and no one said, gee whiz, what was that about last night, Dad? Gee whiz, Dad, how come you had to, you know, throw dinner on the floor? No one said anything because you just want it to be over, and the rhinoceros goes back to being a coffee table, and you just hope that it's going to be different. You know, and that's just, you know, typical behavior in an alcoholic home, just absolutely typical behavior. And you learn early on as a kid, you know, not to bring parent or friends home, because I never know how my dad was going to be. One day he'd be Mr. Friendly Sergeant Guy, and the next day he'd just be this horrible yelling, screaming, and would just, you know, rip us a new one in front of our friends. And you quit telling your parents when you're winning an award at school, because if you've ever had a drunken father show up at a school function, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is just not reserved for the alcoholic. You know, and if you've ever had that happen, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And again, it's just typical behavior in an alcoholic home, just plain old what goes on. I had a lot of resentments towards my mother, too, because I didn't understand why she put up with that stuff. And, you know, why she let my dad be as abusive to her and to us kids, and why she didn't do something about it. But, you know, what I know today is that, again, my mom did the very best with what she had. She wrapped her gift up for us kids with the best stuff she had available to her. You know, she was in a time when you just didn't talk about your stuff. You just kept it to yourself. You made your bed and you lied in it. You know, after my dad had, you know, my mom had divorced my dad finally after a while, and, you know, before he had died and stuff. And one time my sisters and I were sitting around the table talking with her guy, you know, Mom, why did you stay with Dad? She goes, I stayed because of you kids. You know, we're like, gee whiz, Mom, thanks. What can we get you for Christmas this year? Because, you know, but again, you know, one more time, I know my mom did the very best that she could, but one more time, I didn't recognize the package the way that it was wrapped. But anyway, when I was about 12, my dad got out of the Army, and we'd always lived in the East Coast and Europe and stuff like that. So, and then we moved to California, and this was like in the late 60s. So moving to California in the late 60s, out of the military, from the East Coast, was like moving to Mars. I mean, now see, and I'm a rule follower, regulation kid, straight A student in school. I just follow the nose to the grindstone, follow the rules, because I learned early on, you keep your nose clean, stay out of trouble, and the Sarge won't be in your face so much. And so I did everything to the best of my ability that way. But moving to California was unbelievable. Not many rules and regulations in Southern California in the 60s. I mean, it's just this hippy-dippy stuff going on. And us girls are starting to get older, and we're starting to date. Very hard to date in my house. Master Sergeant has lots of rules and regulations about dating. And we'd bring these little weenie boys home to meet my dad. And my dad's like over 6 foot tall, and he has one eyebrow. He can raise like 6 inches over this one side of him. And I can see him today. He'd stand over these little weenie guys, you know, and give them the master sergeant drill, and, you know, and want to know, you know, where we were going, what time we were going to be back. And then he would tell them what part of their anatomy he would rip right off if we were not returned in the virginal condition of which we left the house. Subsequently, very hard to get a second date in my house. Very, very hard. And anyway, so when I met my husband, I should have known there was something wrong with him because my dad liked him right away, but that went right over my head. And my husband, you know, Beverly and I have so many similarities in our story. My husband's several years older than I am. He doesn't like it when I say that, but it's a fact. And I was 17 and he was 24. And we went out on this date and he'd been married once before. And he was now back living with his mom and dad, which might have been clue number two to me that there was something wrong with him. But that went right over my head. And we were going back to his house, and we were with this other couple, and he asked me what I wanted to drink. Well, I'm a rule and regulation person, and I'm 17 years old. It's illegal to drink in the state of California. I am underage, and I told him the rules and regulations of drinking in the state of California. And, you know, and I'm sure, you know, he was totally uninterested in any of that. And he stopped and got a gallon of Red Mountain wine, if nothing else, to impress me what he could consume in sheer volume alone in just one evening, I'm sure. But we did go back to his house, and I drank some of this wine, and I got a little blitzy because I didn't have any drinking history or career of any kind at all. But I watched my husband drink a lot, and I was absolutely fascinated, you know, with his ability to drink and not get violent or angry. Because, again, my conception of drinking was bad things happen. People get hurt. Blood happens. You know, the police show up or the MPs or somebody. Your dad gets busted in rank. That's what happens when I'm around people that are drinking. And then I'm watching my husband drink, and he's just a happy guy. And so, therefore, I figure he can drink because he's happy. Now, I have to let you know, drinkers drink, and that's a bad, you know, alcoholics drinking, bad. You know, Al-Anon's thinking, almost as bad. I mean, it's just, and as an Al-Anon, you get a lot of thinking time, and I certainly am no exception to that rule. But what I've learned over the course of time is I think up stuff. You know, I call it information from nowhere. You know, it's just flying around up here, and it lands here and becomes fact for me. You know, I mean, it's just... That's it. It's just stuff I pull out of nothing. And because I think it, it makes it a fact. So I was sure my husband could handle alcohol. I mean, yes, he drank a lot, but whoopee-doo. He's a happy guy, and I can deal with happy. Needless to say, he was happy a lot. But he was happy, and he was most of the time fun-loving and easygoing, and he got happier. And we would do these fantastically wonderful off-the-cuff things, you know. And my dad was always promising us stuff. We were going to go here, and we were going to do this, and we were going to see this, you know. And then he would start drinking, and one of us would do some little stupid thing, and everything would be called off, and we wouldn't get to do it anymore. And when I was with my husband, it was just the complete opposite of that. He was just this really fun-loving guy. And we had a good time. We went out for a couple years, and drinking was a big part of the deal from the very, very beginning. And my husband was mixing drugs in with that, and it was all in front of me, all in front of my face. And I share that with you because later on, when, you know, I first walked into Al-Anon, if you would have said to me, Larsine, do you have any idea that your husband's drinking, you know, the amount that he's drinking, or do you have any idea that your husband was doing drugs? You know, the day I walked into Al-Anon, I would have said I had absolutely no idea. You know, because how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism is, you know, I see what I want to see until I can't look at it anymore, until I can't justify it or make it work anymore. Then it just goes away from me. You know, and again, information from nowhere lands here and becomes fact for me. I just pretend that I had absolutely no idea that he was doing those kinds of things. Yet I'm here to tell you from the very beginning, the drinking, the drugs, right up front of me, he never hid his stuff. It was just always there. From the very beginning, a blackout drinker. I never understand blackout drinking. I don't know that I ever will. How can someone be standing in front of you talking, doing stuff, and not be there? I do not know. And again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, because I'm trying to be sane about someone's obvious insane behavior. I don't know that he's in a blackout. He says we're doing this and we're going there, and I'm on board and I'm going with him. And I had absolutely no idea that drinking was any part of that stuff. I just didn't quite understand. But I knew from the beginning that I wanted him. I just absolutely positively had to have him. Because up until then, I was just dating these little weenie guys. Boring weenie guys. And he was very exciting from the very beginning because he didn't answer to anybody. He didn't care. He just didn't answer to anybody. I found that absolutely fascinating. But I knew he should answer at least to me, you know. So, you know, somebody should be looking out for him. But anyway, we were dating, and we were having this wonderful time, and everything was just going grand along. We dated for a couple years, and then what ended up happening, and he shared with you, was that I got pregnant. you know, and I don't know if this is a big deal for you, and I don't care if it's a big deal for you, huge deal for me, because I am the rule and regulation queen of the universe. And now I've broken the big rule and the big regulation. And I was sure later on when our life got really, really bad behind the drinking, because God was punishing me. That's the deal. You know, you break the big rule and the big regulation and you get the big punishment from above. You know, and one more time, if you're going to use God, you know, as a reason for not taking responsibility for what's going on for you, because that's certainly what I was doing. What defense do I have against God is punishing me? But that's what I used. Again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism. I'm the responsibility queen until it's too painful, you know, and then I make it be somebody else's fault. How I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism and I don't even know it. I was in Al-Anon a while before someone told me, you know, Larsine, if you screw around and not use any birth control, you might just get pregnant. Just a fact of life. It might just plain old happen. Those, you know, that's the truth. Those are the true words that we learn here. The truth will absolutely set you free. But anyway, in my first year of Al-Anon, we have our AFG convention in Southern California, and in my very first year of Al-Anon, they were shuffling me off, and we do the deal where we get two adjoining hotel rooms, and we cram as many women into these two hotel rooms, and we go off to the convention. And one night we're up in the room, and this is my first year in Al-Anon, and we're having what I call the meeting after the meeting, and there's seven of us women sitting around. And we're having the sharing meeting, and it seems to me, and again, I don't know that this is true, but what I heard was I heard all these women sharing their deepest, darkest secret. So when it came around my turn, I shared my deepest, darkest secret, how I had been pregnant and had to get married. Well, there's seven in the room. Six of them, it turns out, got pregnant, you know, and had to get married. And we decided the seventh was the sickest because she married an alcoholic and didn't have to. And... So you get to learn you're just as sick as your secrets. You know, you are just as sick as your secrets. But again, one more time, what a gift. What a gift. Because that had become a huge deal for me. Just huge. I keep making it bigger and bigger and bigger in my head. And I was making it to such a big deal in my head that when this precious little kid's birthday would roll around, I started to resent that. You know, take it out on the little kid. Blame the little kid. You know, and how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I don't even know it. This is just, you know, again, you know, just how I was affected. But it was a big deal for me. And after Butch and I were married, I would occasionally have to take him to one of my little work functions, and all the way to my work function, I would tell him, now, if somebody asks you when we got married, you tell them, blah, 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 so it works out in the chronological order I know that you want it to work out into. You know, and I've yet to be to a party yet where they go, Butch, it's nice to meet you. What year did you and Larsine get married? You know? Well, boy, we sure do think people think about us all the time, don't we? I mean, we really do. It was really funny because, I don't know, this was a few years ago, but someone, Butch and I were somewhere, and they asked him how long we'd been married, and he just kind of looked at me, you know. I was like, oh, I didn't. I've gotten over it. It's okay now, but... It's great we get to laugh about those things now. But anyway, we got married a month after our son was born, or 2 months after our son was born. So when people would say, were you pregnant when you got married? No, I was not. And you gotta figure it out, you go figure it out. But I was not. And now up until this time, you know, Butch is drinking and he's doing drugs and sometimes he works and sometimes he doesn't and he has blackout drinking and all this stuff is going on and he's this big hippy-dippy guy. He's got a beard down to here, hair down to here, and you know, I've never said anything to him. All this time we're dating, nothing about any of it, you know? I mean, just not a word, not a word, till the day after we got married. And I am not kidding. The day after we got married, I sat him in the kitchen chair and I told him the rules and regulations of the marriage. And I told him from now on we could get a babysitter once a month, but now we have a child, we have responsibilities, obligations, we have to save money. I told him my vision, my goals, my plans. And, you know, on the table of operations, and this is the way it's going to be. Did he understand the rules and regulations of the marriage? He sat in the chair, he did this, which to me was affirmative. But, you know, what I know today, he was so loaded, his head was just going like this. And, you know, and he heard what I know he heard for many years thereafter, which was blah, 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 blah. And, but how do you know? How do you know? You know, and I want you to know that Positively, the driving force behind Butch and I getting married was the fact that we had this child. Absolutely, positively. You know, that's why we got married. But I also want you to know the day that we got married, that Butch was sober that day, and I was as serene as I could be that day, and that we were so sincere in our wedding vows. You know, I believe that standing there that day, that he loved me with all of his heart, and I know that I loved him with all of my heart. And I know that when we took those marriage vows, God, how sincere we were, and that we wanted to honor and love and cherish and take care of each other and nurture each other through sickness and in health. And we took all that stuff dead serious, believe you me. But what Butch and I didn't know was it wasn't just Butch and Larsine that got married that day. It was also the disease of alcoholism. And I'm here to tell you that alcoholism doesn't love or cherish anything. It absolutely positively means to tear your family apart, because that's the family disease of alcoholism. It'll go through the alcoholic or the non-alcoholic, but it's going to get there, and it'll hurt you and your marriage and your family any way it can, because it's just that kind of a devastating disease, cunning, baffling, and powerful. But anyway, Butch and I set off on the marriage path. He always says that's when our little war began. I don't know what he thinks a big war is, but... I mean, I was like all over him from, you know, because, you know, the second day I tell him the rules and regulations of the marriage, right? I think we got it down, right? Well, the third day he violates the rules and regulations of the marriage, because the very third day of our marriage, he doesn't come home all night long. You know, now, I watched my mom for years do nothing, so I am proud to stand before you and tell you my husband begged for the silent treatment. He never got it, not one time. Never, you know. I watched my mom for years do nothing, so I knew that did not work. And I was like a little Pekingese dog boy. The minute he would come in the door, just and curse and cuss. I was just, you know, because I was sure if I put the right mothers and other words together, that like he would have this spiritual awakening or something. You know, and stop what he was doing. And I don't know why I thought that. But again, information from nowhere lands here and becomes fact for me. And it was awful. It was, you know, and my house would have been a quiet place. He was a happy lay down. All he wanted to do was get, you know, drink, get drunk, lay down, pass out. I shared that one time, and he was sitting in the front row, and Hank Johnson was sitting next to him. And Hank leaned over to Butch and said, "Butch, I don't think that's too much to ask for." But, it was way more than I could give him, absolutely. I mean, I was a ranter and a raver and a yeller and a screamer, and I was so angry, and I didn't understand, and I just was just a raging lunatic, cursing, screaming. It was absolutely nuts, just nuts. And I wouldn't let it go. I just wouldn't let it go. He'd be passing out, and I'd be picking him up, shaking him, because I wasn't done. You know, he jokes that I talk as fast as I do, because I only had so much time from when he came home to when he passed out to tell him everything it was. Because by God, he was going to hear it. And I didn't understand. You know, I didn't understand. And I'm here to tell you, over the course of time now, I've probably been to thousands of open Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I've heard absolutely wonderful speakers talk about the disease of alcoholism, and I've gotten a lot out of that. But I'm here to tell you, I do not understand the compulsion to drink, because it is not mine. And that did a lot of damage for me. Because again, I'm thinking, I can drink or not drink. If he loves me and if he loves our kids, then why does he keep doing this? Why? He must not love me. He must not care about me. And one more time, information from nowhere. This is all stuff I just think up and then becomes fact for me. I used to think he was drinking at me. I used to think he was having fun. He never came home looking like he was having fun. You know, but again, just stuff I just start thinking up, and it lands here and it becomes fact for me. Because when you're married to an alcoholic, you got a lot of thinking time. There's just a lot of downtime when you're waiting and you're waiting, and it's the wheels are just spinning, spinning, spinning. And the negative disease of alcoholism, and how I'm affected by it, never let me think a positive thing ever. The minute he is just 10 seconds late, it goes, and we're running and we're off to the bad place. It doesn't matter if he comes home in another minute or he doesn't come home for 3 days. We're off to the bad place. How I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I don't even know it. You know, and it just keeps getting progressively worse. And one night, to show you how drunk he was, he came home like at 2:00 in the morning, and he woke me up. And he demanded to have his dinner. And he'd never done anything like that. And it kind of scared and startled me, you know. So I kind of scurried into the kitchen. But then as I was in the kitchen for a little while, I woke up and I remembered who he was dealing with. And I made this jalapeno pepper that just called, or this Mexican casserole, rather, that just called for one jalapeno pepper, but I had a whole can of the things, you know. So I just cut up every single one of those jalapeno peppers and just stuffed it in there. And he ate it. He's so drunk, his mouth must have been on flaming fire, but he ate it. And then he did what I wanted him to do, and that was go in the bathroom and puke his brains out. You know, because I don't know how you feel, but when my alcoholic throws up, I just get a warm feeling. Just lasts me for days. And, you know, again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I don't even know it. Again, I don't even know it. You know, in the very beginning, you know, when you're married to an alcoholic, their wrongs just always seem this big. They're just huge. They blow the paycheck, just all kinds of the garbage that goes on. You know, and in the beginning, my wrongs seemed so small compared to those. But it wasn't very long. It didn't take very long for me at all for my wrongs to get just as big as his wrongs. I remember sitting there yelling and screaming at him, and I would see the pain in my husband's eyes for the awful things I was calling him and saying about him and doing. And he would say how sorry he was and how he didn't want to ever do it again. You know, and I know that he was telling the truth. I know that he meant that with every fiber of his being. And I would hear the little voice in the back of my head go, stop. Stop yelling. Stop your screaming. You're not bringing anything positive to this. Just stop it. But I couldn't. Is how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism. And then I know that when my husband said he didn't want to do it anymore, that he didn't want to do it anymore. That when he stopped to have a beer after work with the guys, that is what he meant to do, was have a beer with the guys. That, you know, as Beverly shared so well last night, you know, he took the drink and then the drink took him and then he's off, and I don't know if he's going to be back in 6 days or 7 days or what's going to happen down the pike. That's the disease of alcoholism, and I'm trying to make sense of it. And I'm trying to help him in any way I can. That I looked at my watch. I go, it's 6 o'clock, guys. It's now time for me to go home for dinner. I picked up the car keys. I walked to the door. I come back. He's sitting in the kitchen chair. Can you do that? He does this. You know, then do it. You know, what is the problem here? You know, one night he's passed out. I spent half the night whispering in his ear, you don't want to drink. You just want to work and bring Larson the check. You don't want to drink, you just want to work and bring Larson the check. And, again, information from nowhere, woongo, and we're going with it. And, because who do you talk to? I go to work every day and everybody's just having a wonderful time, you know. They had a barbecue on the weekend and they mowed the grass and they planted pansies and stuff like that. How do you tell them? I haven't seen my husband in 7 days. You know, I know he's out there somewhere, or he's home, but we can't find his truck. You know, it's not stuff you want to share with the group, you know, it's just not. And no one else seemed to be having the stuff that was going on in their life, and I didn't understand, and it just gets progressively worse, and I did everything. We tried having another baby. Oh, let's put some more pressure on this guy, you know, let's go there, and, but at least it involved sex, so it was easy, and, but again, you know, just the insanity, just thinking stuff up, thinking whatever I can to try and fix, and I don't know what it is I'm trying to fix. I have no idea. You know, and it just gets progressively worse and progressively worse. And one time I got these calls from his friends, whom I affectionately refer to as scum of the earth people. And these were drug dealer people, bad people, drug dealer people. And they called me up, and my husband, by his own admission today, is a pig, absolute pig, when he uses drugs and alcohol. And these drug dealers called me, and he was so loaded and so drunk and so obnoxious that if I did not come pick him up, the drug dealers, were going to call the police. This is the situation. So, of course, I put on my cape, off to the rescue to go get him, And they've already pushed him out of the house, you know, and they're in the Al-Anon position looking out the Venetian blinds to, you know, to see if I've come to get him. And, you know, and he wanted to drive like he always does, but he was so loaded, he just pushed him and he landed in the back seat of the car. And when I get home and I put our son in his crib and I come down to get my husband, but he's made the fatal mistake of trying to get out of the car without my help. And so he's fallen into the street and he's cracked his head open on the pavement, and blood's gushing out all over the place. I'd like to tell you how concerned I was about him, but I was not. I was only worried that, oh my God, what if the neighbors see? So, you know, and at this point, you know, he's about 200 pounds of, you know, I mean, it's like a 200-pound wet washcloth. There isn't a lot you can do with him. So I've got him up by the ankles, and I'm trying to heave him up over the curb, leading out of his head, to get him down into our apartment so no one will see him. Now, why we call these people normies, I have not a flaming clue. But this normal guy is driving down the street. I've got this guy, he's bleeding out of his head by the ankles, trying to heave him up over the curb. And the normal guy says to me, "Are you having a problem?" And these are the normal people. We don't want to really be like them. And so I said, "Yes, my husband's fallen and he can't get up." And so he helped me get him up, and we lived in a townhouse, and the bedroom was upstairs, and I had to have him upstairs. So not only do I have to get him in the house, I got to get him up a flight of stairs because he's in a head injury, bed, that's where he needs to be. Well, you know, as we're going up the flight of stairs, now the words are flying between he and I, and Mr. Good Samaritan doesn't want to participate anymore. And so we get to the top of the stairs, and the guy's out the door like a bullet, you know, and I just kind of haul Butch the rest of the way, and I laid him on the bed, and now there's this big puddle of blood on the bedspread, and I'm hysterical. Oh, my God. I call 911. I'm so hysterical. They don't know what to do. They sent a hook and ladder truck, the paramedics, you know, the police. They even got a hold of my mother, you know, and I'm in the bedroom with the baby, oh, patting the baby. Oh, my God, this is horrible. Oh, my poor husband. And then the Redondo Beach police come in, and they say, "Mrs. Gantner, your husband says he injured himself because you pushed him down a flight of stairs." And I told them I hadn't done that, but if they'd prop him up, I'd be happy to push him down in front of the Redondo Beach Police Department. And they told me it wouldn't be necessary, and they cleaned him all up. He's got a little weenie cut, needs about 2 or 3 stitches, but he's so drunk they got to take him by ambulance. Now, I don't know how your neighborhood is, but Friday night, hook and ladder truck, my neighbors were all out front. And here comes Butch out on the gurney, his usual friendly self. "Hiya, Frank. Hiya, Joe," you know. And I come out behind a newspaper because I am really big on anonymity at this point in my life, you know, like they won't know it's me. And just the insanity, just the absolute insanity. And somewhere in all this nutso-ness, I called the Council on Alcoholism. You know, I don't know why. I don't know why that day I picked up the phone, but I called the Council on Alcoholism. And I told this woman all the crap that was going on in my house. And no matter what I would say, all she would say was, "I know. I know, I know, I know." And then she said that she had Al-Anon literature and could she please send it to me. And I remember the big brown envelope coming to the house because I know I gave her the right address because it came. But, you know, I cannot tell you to this day if I opened it. I do not remember. But what I know happened for me one more time is by the time that envelope got there, a week, 7 days, however long it took to get there, you know, for us, you know, he started doing what he was supposed to be doing again, and the rhinoceros went back to being a coffee table. You know, and when I'm caught up in it, and I don't even know it. It's how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism. And it gets progressively worse. And, you know, and somewhere in all that, too, you know, I don't know how many months after that, I went to an Al-Anon meeting. Not as a result of getting that, but, you know, again, more disasters, more stuff. And I went to this Al-Anon meeting, and a friend of mine I'd gone to school with, I know that her mother had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and that her father was going to Al-Anon. So I called him up and I asked him if he'd take me to a meeting. He said he'd be happy to. And he took me to an Al-Anon meeting. It was a wonderful meeting with very nice people and wonderful literature on the table, but it didn't have the piece of literature that I wanted, and that's the piece that says how to get them sober and do what you want them to do. Because that was all that I was interested in, believe you me. And if you're new and you're in this meeting or any meeting and you don't want to be there, it's so easy to find a reason to leave. It's so easy to find, you know, you don't have to work at it at all. You will find why these people don't apply to you, why your case is different. And I was sitting in that front row, and they read something, and they said, if somebody's drinking bothers you, then you should come to Al-Anon. Well, there you go. You guys are bothered. I am pissed off. Another whole level of nirvana, you know. I mean, where are the meetings for the pissed off people, please? I could deal with bothered. That would be okay. I would be happy with bothered. And you know, and what I know is because I didn't want to be there. You know, if you would have said to me, "Larsine," when I was sitting in that meeting, "Larsine, do you want your life to be different?" God, did I want my life to be different. Please tell me how my life could be different. You know, but "Larsine, what are you willing to do about it?" Nothing. Because there's nothing wrong with me. You fix him and I'll be okay. And that was my attitude, and I sat at that meeting with that attitude. I wanted you to tell me how to fix him. I didn't want to know what I could do for myself or my children. I wasn't interested in any of that. It didn't work for me, you know, because I had no willingness to do anything different. And so, and I remember at the very end of my husband's drinking, you know, it's getting worse and worse, and he never raised a hand to me. He never hit me, never did anything like that, never threatened to hit me. But I'm there sitting there one time, and I'm just, rage is just coming out of me. Just unbelievable rage. I am just white hot mad. And And he's drunk and loaded, and we were supposed to do something, and one more time we can't, because one more time he's just messed it all up. And I'm sitting there now, and all I know to keep doing is pushing harder. I'm not going in any kind of right direction, but I just keep pushing harder in the wrong direction. So I'm sitting there with my finger in his chest. Let's take it to the next level. Why don't you hit me? And I'm egging him to hit me. This is where we're going now, and I'm just pushing on him and yelling at him and cursing and sticking my finger in his chest right in his face. And I became very conscious of our two little boys who at that time were 5 and 3 years old. And they're standing on either side of me, and they're yanking down on my pant leg, and they're begging me, "Mommy, Mommy, please stop yelling at Daddy." And I would like to tell you that I had a moment of clarity then, but I absolutely did not. What I started doing was I started yelling at those two little boys. How dare they? How dare they tell me to stop yelling at their dad? He's the idiot here. He's the reason our life is the big mess that it is. And by the time I get done yelling at these two little innocent children, I look up and I watch the drunken, loaded alcoholic walking out the front door. And I, the sober mother, turn to the drunken father and say, "Where the hell do you think you're going?" And the drunken father turns to the sober parent and says, "I'm leaving because we're upsetting the children." And I tell you this because, not because I'm proud of it, because this is where the disease of alcoholism took me, and I don't even know it. I don't even know I'm being affected. Heck, I think I'm close to sainthood here. I think I'm the one that's holding it all together and being the big brave one, and if it wasn't for me, we would all be apart, you know, because I can't even recognize my own part. The sickness that's coming out of me, that I'm spewing on these children, I'm spewing on a man who's already sick and helpless. I have absolutely no idea that this is how I'm being affected. I love in our literature where it says we become nervous and irritable without knowing it. And why? Because we try and force solutions. If there's anything I'm guilty of, it's trying too hard. You know, trying is a good thing, but trying too hard does me in every time. And what I've learned is the key word there is too. Because when I'm trying too hard, it means I'm trying for more than me. I'm trying to do his part, or I'm trying to do my kid's part, or I'm trying to do God's part. I just got to try and do my part. That's where I got to keep the focus on. But anyway, lo and behold, he gets sober. Woo-hoo. And who would have thunk it? You know, on a scale of 1 to 10, I wouldn't give his last drunk a 5. Why that's the one that got him sober, I have absolutely no idea. Absolutely none whatsoever. And God was working in his life. I don't believe that God was working in mine, but I believe that God was working in my husband's. You know, he got arrested for drunk driving. No big deal. He gets arrested lots of times for drunk driving. I mean, it just wasn't that big of a deal. But I had called the hospital that night. Again, don't ask me why. I had no idea. They gave me the name of the doctor on call. Fine, I hung up. I went to bed. The police called me, come pick him up in the morning. I did. But I know that God was working in his life, because believe you me, it takes a power greater than anything you've seen in your life to keep my mouth shut. And I picked him up and I said nothing. I said nothing. I even had the number of a doctor and I said nothing. And then he came home and he stayed upstairs for 2 whole days. You know, when he comes down and says he needs help, you know, I gave him the number. I didn't make the call. I didn't make the arrangements. I did nothing, which is so totally not me. I can't even begin to tell you. And that's how I know that God was working in my life, or Butch's life, because I believe that he surrendered that night, you know, a couple of days ago. And that God literally pushed me out of the way so that my husband could find his own sobriety and find the path that he had to go. And he went to the psychiatric unit, you know, and they were doing all this stuff and taking all the razors away from him. And I remember getting ready to leave him, and I get to the big double doors at the back of the room, and he called my name, you know, Larsine, you know, and I think, well, he's changed his mind. He doesn't want to stay. Fine with me. I'm not too happy about leaving him here. What will the neighbor say? And so I walk back to him, and he reaches into his pocket, and he handed me the Valium that he brought in case of emergency. You know, and I knew, because he'd never parted with the Valium in his life, you know, that things were going to be different. Now, I went home and I took it because I was just a basket person. And, I think I slept for like 17 hours on one little 10 milligram, but I was tired, too. And, but anyway, he was there for a couple of weeks in the psychiatric unit. Now, to cheer him up, we have a son in kindergarten and one in preschool. So I would take, you know, to the hospital and show him what the boys had made in kindergarten and preschool. But oh no, he wanted to show me what he made in occupational therapy that day, you know. So I take it home, show it to the boys. We'd hang it on the refrigerator. Look what Daddy did. Ooh, he's sober. We're so proud. Yep, this is it. This is the next ride on the alcoholic merry-go-round or whatever. And I didn't know what to expect. I mean, I didn't know what to. And after he, you know, did his spin over there. Truly, truly grateful. And because he was dead. I used to come home from work and he'd be passed out on the kitchen floor between all the alcohol and drugs, and I was sure he was ODing, and I didn't know what to do, and I keep checking his pulse, and you know, and the boys, I mean, they didn't know what to do with him either, but they were never afraid of their dad. I mean, he'd be passed out on the kitchen floor and they'd build Tinker Toy bridges over him and tie Tonka trucks to him and pretend he was Gulliver, you know, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, they just went right along with the whole deal, you know, but, you know, my gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, besides the fact that it saved my husband's life, you know, it didn't just save my husband's life, because it saved a family's life. Because my husband, I'm not kidding, he, you know, I don't know how much longer he had. Who can ever say? But, you know, I know that if he would have died that death, there would have been one very bitter, angry, nasty woman raising these two little boys. How much more damage do you think that, even though he died, that disease just keeps on churning, just keeps on rolling on down? And, you know, and when I cry, it's not because my husband lived, because I was personally rooting for death at the time. But, it's because our family was saved. It absolutely positively was. But anyway, you know, Butch is in the hospital, and they didn't have any family therapy at all. This was in 1979, and when they get sober, it's all about the alcoholic. Woo, you know. And that's all we care about. That's all we want to talk about. You be nice. You be good. You go home. Do this to the house. Do that to the house, you know. And it was just like, God, I hated it. You know, it was just all about him. And, you know, usually when I go to these things, you know, it's always an Alcoholics Anonymous convention with Al-Anon participation, you know, in little teeny tiny print. That always pisses me off. And, because, boy, when they're in jail, they want some Al-Anon participation then, don't they? Yeah. Hey, sign me up. And, but anyway, it was all about, you know, all about him being sober and all this stuff. And he started going to meetings, and I'm helpful. I went with him the first 6 months to make him sure he heard what he's supposed to hear. He's not very smart, and he needs my help. And but after 6 months, I got tired of going to AA, and I certainly thought he should too. God, there's only 12 steps. How stupid are you? And I'd already done them like 17 times myself. You know, it was like, come on, come on, come on. But he made it clear to me that Alcoholics Anonymous was the most important thing in his life, and he was going to go, and that's all there was to it, and I could like it or not like it. And so he kept going to AA, so occasionally after that, I would go with him to like a birthday meeting or an anniversary meeting or something like that. And, you know, and alcoholic women would come up to me, and they would go, are you Butch's wife? And I'd go, yes, I am. And they go, well, we just love him. He's so wonderful. Yeah. Chapter 5, how it works. You know, you get them sober and some alcoholic woman steals them away from you, you know. Again, information from nowhere lands here becomes fact for me. And, you know, and now I can look back at that, you know, and I can see why, you know, it's like I was going to AA meetings and here's lovely women in Alcoholics Anonymous, sober women. And they're beautiful and they're gorgeous and they're laughing and they're having a good time. You know, and I know he wasn't coming home to that. He was coming home to the screaming Mimi, yakking, because I did not know how to stop. You know, I'd always said, when Butch is a good enough husband, I'm going to be fine. When Butch is a good enough father, I'm going to be just fine. When Butch goes to work every day and brings home a paycheck, I'm going to just be fine. When Butch is sober, I'm going to be just fine. And here we are 2 years down the road of his sobriety, and he is doing way beyond any expectations I had for him. And I was not fine. Boy, I was not fine at all. It's like my friend Crazy Jean says, it's like they get sober and you're out of a job. You know, and that's just, you know, and I went to lots of AA meetings. I was always made to feel welcome at AA meetings, but I'm here to tell you I'm not an alcoholic, and as much as I get out of open Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, my recovery doesn't lie there. My recovery lies in the family groups of Al-Anon, but I did not know that. And then as my husband said, you know, he decided he was going to go to a conference. I could go or not go, but hell, I knew there were going to be alcoholic women in bikinis. You know, my God, I got to go and watch him and protect him and save him. And that's what happened. You know, we went to the family meeting, and there was an Al-Anon, an Al-Ateen, and an AA speaker. And these people were not related at all. Just a family meeting. They had these three separate people, had nothing to do with each other, but they each shared their story, and they shared about the family disease of alcoholism. And what happened for me sitting in that audience is I became this much willing to do something different. And I'm here to tell you that that's all you have to be, is that much. So when I came back, I started going to Al-Anon for all the right reasons. I didn't come to get an alcoholic sober. He already was. I didn't come to keep him sober. He was doing fine on his own. I came because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, when they say we work the steps, we go to meetings, we get a sponsor, we read the literature. Well, I'm a rule and regulation person. here I am. I got a sponsor immediately. And I see people in Al-Anon, you know, they're in Al-Anon for years and they still don't have a sponsor because they're looking for somebody just like them. Like, how stupid can you be? You know, why do you want someone who knows how you think? That's dumb. You know, I wanted someone who was nothing like me, so I got a sponsor that was older than my mother, who never had sobriety in her home, was divorced from her alcoholic, didn't have little kids. She had a thick Dutch accent. You could hardly understand a word she said. You know, and that's who I picked. That's who I want from my sponsor. And so I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said yes. And the very first time I used her as a sponsor, Butch was going to work one morning, and he had a dead battery. And so he asked me to jump it. I did, and after I jumped it, he ran out of gas. Now, I used to say he yelled at me because this made him angry. Yes, it made him angry, but he didn't yell. He just yelled. That's all there was to it. It's not that big of a deal, but it was then because he yelled, so I yelled right back at him. And so he went off to work, and I went upstairs and called my sponsor and reported his behavior and told her exactly what had happened. And she said, you know, as soon as I got done, she says, when Butch gets home tonight, you tell him you are sorry for what you said. It was unkind and unnecessary. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, Jeannie doesn't know how we do things in America. And she missed the crucial who started, which I always think is so important. And so I became necessary for me. I didn't want to tell her she was stupid, so I started telling her the story again because she missed a lot of crucial, very important things, obviously. So halfway through the second telling, she says, don't tell me this story again. I heard you the first time. And don't you ever, ever call me again and start a conversation with Butch said or Butch did. I am not Butch's sponsor. I am Larcine's sponsor. And for what she said to her husband, she owes them an amends. That's it. Goodbye. Click. End of conversation. You know, I learned valuable lessons. Never, ever call your sponsor first thing in the morning because you've got all day long to think about what she told you to do. Don't do that. Never call your sponsor when you're going to see her that night at the meeting because she's going to want to know if you follow direction, you know. And I'm a rule and regulation person. I have no choice. I must do this. So I got all day long to think about that. And when Butch walked in the door that night and he came in, I told him I was sorry I let his shitty attitude affect me the way that it had. And that I would try and do better in the future. Now, I know that's not the best amends that you can make. But one more time. You know, I was this much willing to do something different. And I had never told him I was ever sorry, because it was always his fault. It was always his fault. You know, but I became this much willing to do something different. You know, and I'm here to tell you, that's all you have to be, is just this much willing. This much willing will take you lots and lots of places. And it wasn't the best, but I've gotten much better at it over the course of time. But I took that first step out there. I trusted what my sponsor said to me that I should do. Maybe I didn't do it exactly in the perfect way, but nowhere does it say perfect in our literature. And I see people beat themselves out of Al-Anon all the time because they don't think they're getting it fast enough. Because you go to meetings and you see people who have been coming a long time, and it's wonderful to see the recovery that they have in their home and their lives and whatever's going on. But I'm here to tell you, you know, if you want 25 years in Al-Anon, you got to go to meetings and work the steps and do the stuff for 25 years. It's just the way it works. You know, it's one day at a time, but you're going to get there. You know, but we all want it right now, you know, because that's us Al-Anons. We got to hurry up and catch up all the time and try and make it better as fast as we can. And it's not about fast. It's about this much at a time, the willingness to do this much at a time. And you're going to get there. My whole life in Al-Anon has just been this much at a time. You know, I was really bad in the gratitude department, really bad in the God department. You know, I was so afraid. I didn't want God in my life. I don't need any help. And my whole meeting one night, I used to go to this little Wednesday night meeting at my friend Crazy Jean's house, and they knew the big struggle I was having with the higher power thing. So these 12 people, the whole meeting, each one went around the room and shared their God with me for my benefit. And when the meeting was over, Jean said to me, Larcine, from everyone sharing, do you think you can find your God from this? Heck no way, Jean. Thank you. I appreciate everybody sharing, but I'm just not going to get the God thing. And Jean says to me, you know, Larcine, why God gave you ears. And I'm nasty to Jean is because I know he's a Mr. Sarcastic, Mr. Al-Anon. What do you think they call him Crazy Jean for? And, you know, and so I said, yes, Jean, so I can hear what the people are trying to tell me. And Jean goes, in most people's cases, that's true. But in your case, Larcine, God gave you something to hold on to while you yank your head out of your ass. And, and that's where my head is. When I fight, you know, when I fight what is so freely offered to me here, you know, and that's just the deal is. It's not that I don't want, it's just that I don't know how. means I have to ask you for help. The scariest thing I have to do is ask you how to do it, because I'm used to information. I like to do it this way, and that way just hurts me over and over and over again. When I was about 15 years in Al-Anon, and I share this story with you because this is kind of like a real deal for me. It's about what the program is really all about, how important it is for me to need you guys, and why it's so important for me to keep coming back. Butch and I have been to a conference, wonderful conference, fantastic speakers, workshops, unbelievable. And it's one of those conferences when we came home and, you know, you walk in the door and like serenity's coming out of every orifice of your body. You know, you're just all lifted with the spirit and the miracles and all the wonderful stuff. And so we come home from this wonderful conference. I am full of nothing but goodness from these programs. And I exercise when I'm at home, and I have a treadmill, and that's what I like to do. So I change into my exercise togs and to go walk on the treadmill. And my youngest son, who was living at home, was then 20 years old, and he had his weight bench by my treadmill. And I walk up to this weight bench, and I find a woman's driver's license on it, and I pick it up, and I can tell how old she is. She's 32 years old. She lives in Glendora. But I immediately, in 10 seconds or less, deduce that this woman has been in the house over the weekend, had sex with my 20-year-old son, has two kids, wants to marry him, and call me mom. I am there right now, you know, and, you know, again, information from nowhere. Whing, it's right here. So I run into the house, and I lay the driver's license down in front of Butch, and he just looks at it, you know, because no imagination, the guy has nothing, and nothing. And, so I tell him what I think happened over the weekend, and his eyes roll back in his head like they usually do, and he tells me, you know, Carol's my sponsor now. Cold call, Carol, you're sick, you're wacky, you're lunatic. And so I call up Carol, and I tell her what I think happened, and she, now Carol rarely gives me direction, but this particular day she told me to shut up. And she says, another thing, when that kid comes home, when your son comes home, don't you dare dump on him the garbage that you made up, that you think happened. See, at that particular time, my son was having lots of problems, and I was very fearful, very, very fearful for the stuff that was going on in his life. And it's not that there wasn't enough stuff going on, that I had to even make up more negative stuff, the negative disease of alcoholism. What I'm trying to share with you is I'm 15 years in the program. I'm going to meetings. I'm sponsored. I've just been to this wonderful conference. Been 10 seconds alone in the garage. The negative disease of alcoholism will take me to the dark side every flaming time, every time, unless I come to you and tell you this information I've made up, and then you put me on the track. Larsine, shut up. Don't go there. It's your fear that's talking. Leave it be. And so anyway, she gave me that specific instruction, so I didn't say anything to my kid. I didn't say nothing. And as it turned out, I didn't see him for 2 days because his school schedule and my work schedule and his work schedule. And 2 days later, he walks into the kitchen, and now I've forgotten about the driver's license because it's been 2 days. I've thought up all kinds of other disasters that have come and gone already. And so he walks in the kitchen with the driver's license, and he says, Mom, what do you do when you find a driver's license? Well, I don't tell him what I do when I find a driver's license. So not a good example. But see, alone, this is why. Why do we keep going to meetings? That's why I keep going to meetings. Because I didn't need to make this kid feel bad about himself. You know, it got told to me it takes just as much energy to put out positive thoughts for the people that we're worried about as it does positive. Pray for them. Think good things their way. It's the same amount of energy you're expending. You know, you don't need to be sending negative stuff out there. Fear, fear, fear runs my life sometimes. And someone once told me what fear stands for. It's forgetting everything's all right. And most of the time, when I'm in the spooky place, everything is perfectly fine right now. But my head will take me there. That's why it's so important for me to keep going to you guys. About 3 weeks ago, I was at a conference in North Dakota, and my oldest son and his wife were expecting their first child. I cannot tell you how excited I was about this. And the child was due on the 14th of May, and I had to be in North Dakota on the 16th. And the child didn't come, and I talked to God before I left. God, no baby till I get back on Monday. We were in agreement. God did this, I was sure. And my plane no sooner lands in North Dakota, and I'm going to the speaker dinner, and my husband calls, and this baby's been born. And I was so angry. I was livid. I called my sponsor and wanted to resign from Al-Anon on the spot. I want out. This isn't fair. I need to be there for my family, too. This is crap. And then my sponsor had her sponsor call me. Now, when your grand sponsor calls, you've gone over the edge. You're gone.
Because they bring out the big guns now, you know. You're in trouble. You have messed up. And, but they were nothing but loving and kind to me. They said I could resign the next day after I slept on it and I prayed about it. And they were reassuring and loving and kind. And then they asked me the big question. You know, Larsine, did you turn your will and your life over to the care of God today? Well, yeah, I did. Well, did you mean that, or is that just words you just say when it's convenient for you? And so I got to pray about that, and I got to think about that that night. And one more time, I got to see the package was delivered to me. God gave me this beautiful, beautiful grandson, but because it didn't come in the package that I wanted it to come in, I almost missed the gift. I made it be all about me. I made it be all about me. And this is 3 weeks ago. This is 3 weeks ago. Left to my own devices, I get in a bad place. I got a friend, Bob Fisher. He says people quit coming to Al-Anon because they quit being amazed. You know, don't quit being amazed. If you can't amaze yourself, then be amazed by the other people that are at the meeting. Go to AA. They amaze me all the time. You know, but go where you got to go and keep being amazed. You know, and hang on to the people that are next to you because those are the real heroes that are here. Those are the real deal. And, you know, and yeah, I can't thank you enough for this weekend and the fun time that you've shown me and my husband. We've just had the best time in the whole world. You know, and I don't mean to imply that, you know, we're walking down this wonderful path of life. I love my husband, and I know that he loves me. But I know by next Wednesday, I'm going to think he's the biggest dork that ever walked down the face of the planet. And I know he'll think the same about me. But again, we get into the acceptance and the loving and the kindness, and we keep going to meetings, and we keep being sponsored. You know, and you guys keep showing us the path to go. I'm amazed that I had to come to a room full of strangers to learn how to love my own family. But that's what I had to do, and I don't know how I can thank you enough for that gift. I've got his little tiny wooden statue at home, and on it is a little wood block with a little tiny wooden candle on it. It says, a candle loses nothing of its light by lighting another candle. The world just burns a little brighter. I want to thank you guys from the bottom of my heart for lighting my candle.